ladies and gentlemen, we have Phil Zwickler here tonight, who has been friends with numerous individuals in the music field, and he's going to be talking to us tonight about his relationship with a drummer known as Ainsley Dunbar.
Ainsley Dunbar. Oh my gosh. You know, if Ainsley hears this, this is really why I have to say that, you know, once my friend Denny invited me to a show with a band he was working with, and from backstage, I hung out through the show until he was finished. And at the end, I said, "Wow, your drummer was awesome. Whoever played drums was really great." And he said, "That's my friend Ainsley." And I'm like, "Oh, great." And I saw Ainsley Dunbar come backstage, and I said, "You know what? You're the best drummer I have ever heard. Will you play drums on my record?" And the guy says, "Yeah, send me what you got, and I'll play drums for you," right? And I sent him my Big Ideals kit with a whole musical, and this is the drummer, and this was his part. And he calls me back, and he goes, "I thought you just maybe had a tune or something. I didn't know you were going to send me a big, you know, musical." And he goes, "Besides, I think you're just trying to use my name as an advantage for your career." And I said, "No, that's not what I'm doing. I didn't even realize that you're the Ainsley Dunbar that has been a star since the 1950s, who has over 120 gold records." And Ainsley Dunbar, he played drums for Alice Cooper. He played drums for Journey, Whitesnake, Elton John. He even actually auditioned to be the drummer for Kiss. But he didn't take it because he had short hair and Kiss wanted guys with long hair. But anyway, we ended up being friends, Ainsley and I. And I wish that I would have, like, been good enough for him to say, "Hey, I'll play drums on your thing." But he thought, you know, I was trying to get a hold of his fame, but I didn't even know he was, like, the great drummer that he is.
So you'd never met Ainsley Dunbar before?
No, I didn't know that he was God himself.
You didn't know what group he played with? Or?
No. All I knew is that he played with the World Classic Rockers. And he was like, I was focusing on my friend Denny, who was doing sound. So this was just another band, you know? And I just thought, wow, whoever that is that's playing drums is really doing a wonderful job. I wish I could have a drummer like him, right? And I said, "Hey, Ainsley, I'll send you my package." And he goes, "Yeah, send me my package. I'll play drums." And I sent him this huge Big Ideals thing. And he sent me a thing back going, "I think you're just trying to get my fame." And I'm like, "What fame?"
So did you take his response as kind of a, you know, egotistical kind of, you're just going after me because I have a name, and as far as my personality or who I am, really has no matter.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he was, like, being aggressive like that. It was more like he had seen so many other people who were trying to take advantage of his fame that he thought I was just amongst them. But he really was a nice guy, and he didn't know. He just thought that I was another guy trying to get involved with his fame. Really, he was just my friend Denny's friend, you know, and I just thought he played drums great. That's all. I didn't even know he was God himself with 120 gold records dating back to the 50s. But eventually we became friends, and, you know, he really helped me. Even though he wasn't going to play on my thing, he really helped me.
So in the long run, he stepped forward and came through for you, and
yeah, and we're friends now. Instead of being involved musically, we're just friends, you know? Because all he knew was that I was a sound guy, friend of Denny's, and all I knew was that he was some guy named Ainsley who played drums really good, instead of the Ainsley Dunbar that he is and still is.
So you still remain in contact with this gentleman?
Or? Oh, yeah. Yeah, if I ever see them play as the World Classic Rockers, you know, we definitely hang out, you know. Wow, he's really, yeah, he's really, you know, he knows who I am, and I think he's the greatest drummer. You know, he really is. Whenever I hear him play, it totally just inspires me.
So tell me, Phil, I noticed that you've also worked with James Brown. What was your experience with James Brown?
Okay, James Brown, that was in Simi Valley, and here's what happened. He was playing at Wet n' Wild, which was a water park, and my friend Jody, who was a magician, he had a show that was rehearsing in Glendora, and we went to this bar, and the whole band that was playing backup for James Brown was there, okay? And we were just hanging out, and he was saying, hey, you know, we're the band that's backing up James Brown at Wet n' Wild, you know, at the water park.
So it really wasn't a James Brown band. I mean, it wasn't something you, from your impression, that he had assembled and brought there to support
him. I think it was like local musicians that were hired to back up James Brown for his appearance at the Wet n' Wild place, okay? And all of a sudden, as we sat there, James Brown walks in. And he's just trying to tell the four guys at the bar that they've changed the rehearsal time. Okay, from, let's say, 4 o'clock to 3 o'clock. Okay, so he just came back, and he was like, hey, how you doing, Stevie? How you doing, Bobby? You know, hey, we changed the rehearsal time. I just thought I'd let you guys know, and I'll see you later, but... within 2 seconds, everyone in the whole place realized that that was James Brown. And so we all started, like, treating him like James Brown. And he took pictures with everybody. And he was saying, hey, you know, I don't drink anymore. You know, I don't smoke anymore. I don't do anything like that. I'm just, you know, telling my friends. And they bought him, like, a glass of ice water. And we just hung out, and James Brown told us a bunch of great stories about being in show business.
Do you remember what selections he sang that night?
Well, you know what? I was working for Jody Baron and working on his shows, so I didn't go back, and I never did work the stage with James Brown, but I did get to hang out with him at the bar in Glendora. And it was so cool.
So what, if you had to name one thing that, like, really struck a chord with you with James Brown, what would that be? His personality, his enthusiasm, his inspiration, you know?
Yeah, his, you know what? It was so cool. He was just, the thing that I remember is his voice. His voice was just... He knew that everyone in the bar recognized him, and all he would have to do is go, wow, I feel good, you know, and everybody knew it was him, but he was like, hi, how you doing? And he just, like, he would shake your hand, and he always said, this is another great part of his, like, that anyone who knew James Brown will back me up on, is whenever he said his name, he said it twice. He always said, hi, my name's James Brown. James Brown! And I said, hey, I'm Phil. It's so nice to meet you, you know? And he goes, oh, nice to meet you, James Brown. James Brown!
So he's a very personable person.
Really personable man. And even though he was like, I don't drink anymore, I don't smoke, you know, I'm perfectly happy. And he took pictures, you know, and posed for pictures with fans for 10 or 15 minutes at least before he left. And I thought he was a perfect, you know, gentleman.
if we can slide out of the music scene for a minute, what can you tell me about Tiger Woods? When did you first meet Tiger Woods, and under what circumstances?
Okay, I was about to play golf at a place called Hartwell's in Long Beach, California, and I noticed that there was a lot of... The year was about 1989.
Early on in his career.
88, 89, you know, maybe even earlier, maybe even 87. But he was there, and everybody said, "Hey, Tiger Woods." And they called him Little Tiger Woods then. This is how young he was. They called him Little Tiger Woods. Okay? And my friend... We just played golf at Hartwell's, which is a golf course he used to play near Cypress, California.
And country club? Public course?
No, it was a public course, and it was like a par three, you know, that everybody in that neighborhood would play. It was just a municipal kind of situation. And then, 9 holes later, I went to the snack bar to get a drink. And who came up right behind me but Tiger Woods? And Tiger said... And I'm not even kidding. He said, "Excuse me, sir." And I was only like 18, 20, you know, and he was 12. He said, "Excuse me, sir, could I go in front of you because I'm in a tournament right now?" Or something like that. And I said, "Oh, yeah, sure." And then when he went ahead of me and got his drink, I realized that he was Little Tiger Woods that I had seen on The Tonight Show. And I just remembered that he was at least polite, and he said, "Excuse me, sir." He didn't say, "Get out of my way, I'm Tiger Woods, the superstar that we know today." He said, "Excuse me, sir, could I please go ahead of you?" And I said, "Go ahead," and I still recognized him. And so he still played at Tiger at Hartwell's, and I was just, at least now, glad that I had the, you know, brush with greatness with Tiger Woods.
So do you think he's been able to maintain his image coming forward even to today in spite of all the press and situations?
Yeah, I don't know if he's retained his... You know, I've heard, you know, many other stories of him not being kind to people and not, you know, as what I remembered, you know, and having this problem with his wife. And I mean, we all wish we know what we would do if we had the fame of Tiger Woods. And if you had 15 Scandinavian women every day wanting to hump your brains out, would you cave and would you eventually, you know, cave in, or would you be the, "Oh no, I'm only, you know," but
it, so you see Tiger Woods is that classic example of the person who has perhaps everything they've ever desired, like, thrown at their feet. Somebody who is like seduced into this walking kind of, in a way, anesthetization that they just like creep through.
Yeah.
And kind of
amazing.
Like tune out their other life.
They have to tune out their other life. Imagine if we had that kind of life. You know, we wish for one woman who would fawn over us. Imagine having 500 women fawn over us.
Well,
not even fawning. exactly, way beyond fawning. I mean, way beyond fawning. We can't even imagine beyond fawning because, you know, most people could think of where we are now and fawning. Okay, you can't even imagine having 500 Scandinavian women ready to hump your brains out. You know, you can only imagine, but you signed the agreement and, you know, he got into that, you know, Frank Sinatra mode where he had these people watching him, but they didn't watch out for him.
So you think maybe his people who were in charge and managed him and stuff were, let's say, not negligent, but like lackadaisical with what they, how they watched over him, how they really tried to keep him safe.
Do you think that his caddy, tried to keep him safe? Of course they tried to keep him safe, but, there's so many variables when you have someone of worldwide importance like Gandhi or Muhammad Ali or Tiger Woods, where there's multiple countries involved where you don't even know who's most involved in, trying to sway you one way or the other, regardless of your prowess on the golf course.
So do you think there's a lot of consistency between, Tiger Woods is a sports figure, he's a golf champion. Do you see this kind of like thread going between, say, this figure like Tiger Woods versus, an actor such as Bill Cosby, or a blues singer like James Brown, that constant temptation thrown in their face?
Yeah, James Brown, he, imagine like me seeing him in Simi Valley, San Dimas, California, and him performing in Detroit, Michigan, where he's dealing with a much different demographic, and yet he could sell out a house in either place. And the same with Tiger Woods, selling out wherever he goes, and Bill Cosby. I was lucky enough to run into Bill Cosby, and it was a wonderful thing, but he's another major figure, another major like person where people just happen to recognize his name. But there's many things that happened in his life that didn't have anything to do with show business, and many things happened to James Brown that had nothing to do with show business. And the same with Tiger Woods. I ran into him when he was just at a snack bar. And so there are many things that happened to Tiger Woods that had nothing to do with popularity and anything to do with people knowing who they are and what they do.
So we're talking here, Bill Cosby, James Brown, Tiger Woods, we're talking about three African Americans who have been able to like achieve success, who have actually like clawed their way up in a lot of ways to be successful people. How do you reconcile certain situations like this recent stuff with Tiger Woods and his wife? And
it's a really hard question, to know who is still part of that racial bias and who has moved on to, as we know that the earth gets smaller and smaller as we discover more and more, people know, and yet race becomes a smaller issue as time goes on.